Continuing in chapter 12, the divine work tonight. The last sentence of the last section. Even in his transcendence of cosmic limitations, he is still one with all in God. A divine work remains for him in the universe. So here we have the three great terms of being coming into consummation here on earth in a progressive divine work. That's the context as we take up this next section. That work cannot be fixed by any mind-made rule or human standard. For his consciousness has moved away from human law and limits and passed into the divine liberty. Away from government by the external and transient, into the self-rule of the inner and eternal. Away from the binding forms of the finite, into the free self-determination of the infinite. Howsoever, he lives and acts, says the Gita. He lives and acts in me. This is the sixth chapter of the Gita, the 31st shloka, which reads in translation, the yogin who has taken his stand upon oneness, ekatvam, and loves me, in all beings, however, and in all ways he lives and acts in me. The rules which the intellect of men lays down cannot apply to the liberated soul. By the external criteria and tests which their mental associations and prejudgments prescribe, such a one cannot be judged. He is outside the narrow jurisdiction of these fallible tribunals. It is immaterial whether he wears the garb of the ascetic or lives the full life of the householder, whether he spends his days in what men call holy works, or in the many-sided activities of the world, whether he devotes himself to the direct leading of men to the light, like Buddha, Christ, or Shankara, or governs kingdoms like Janaka, or stands before men like Sri Krishna, as a politician or a leader of armies, what he eats or drinks, what are his habits or his pursuits? Whether he fails or succeeds, whether his work be one of construction or of destruction, whether he supports or restores an old order or labors to replace it by a new, whether his associates are those whom men delight to honor or those whom their sense of superior righteousness outcasts and reprobates, whether his life and deeds are approved by his contemporaries, or he is condemned as a misleader of men and a fomenter of religious, moral, or social heresies. He is not governed by the judgments of men or the laws laid down by the ignorant. He obeys an inner voice and is moved by an unseen power. His real life is within. And this is its description, that he lives, moves, and acts in God, in the divine, in the infinite. So this whole paragraph is an explication of what is contained in this one shloka in the Gita. And he lists these social mores which govern most men's activities, and says clearly that they are not incumbent as rules upon the liberated, the enlightened soul. Because we cannot, looking into his person, see their state of consciousness. When our eyes are fixed on the material, when they're bound by senses, when they guess with what limited mental acuity they have, they cannot understand what is the nature of a spiritual personality, what is the content of a spiritual consciousness. So, it is ironic Sri Aurobindo is writing here, because look at this list. Whether he wears the garb of the ascetic, Sri Aurobindo did not wear the garb of the ascetic. His clothes were typically white, but kurtas were white. He wore often only the upper cloth and a dhoti. But he never renounced the world. He never took sannyasa. So whatever state of existence was his, it was founded in the spirit, not in external judgment. Did he do holy works? He wrote poetry, he wrote philosophy, he answered questions. Whatever he did from a divine consciousness. That is the point. Did he directly lead people to the light? You might say unwillingly. Sri Aurobindo was not avid to be a teacher and wanted to help someone awaken to the reality of the omnipresent spirit. Then they would need no more instruction. Once you have that living experience, it unfolds its own teaching to you through its own self-light. He had no need even to ascend to the topmost ranks of political leadership. You'll remember that he was a leader of the Nationalist Party in India to try to throw off the shackles of the British. But when that work was disposed to others, he went on with equality, with samatha, to the larger work that was given to him by the inner Lord of all, and worked on the liberation of all by the establishment of an integral yoga. What he eats or drinks, Sri Aurobindo, until the mother felt it best, smoked cigars, drank the glass of wine, ate fish, but he drew himself into compliance with the rules that she had established for everybody else in the ashram, so that he didn't stand out as an exception. Not that he was attached to any of these things, not that he desired them. He didn't drop them the second it became appropriate. Whether he fails or succeeds. Remember the Cripps proposal in 1942, wasn't it? Whether he supports or restores an old order, or labors to replace it by a new. And whether you win or lose in that, the very effort has an effect. Etc. You see all of this. You continue to work from a liberated consciousness in whatever it is comes to you according to the hidden will of the unseen. And this goes back to the Gita again in verse 20 in chapter 3. It was even by works that Janaka and the rest attained to perfection. So Janaka was not the only one in the whole long history of India who had spiritual realization and yet continued to work positively in life. The verse continues, "You also should do works for the holding together of the peoples." And we'll get to that in a moment, but this is Loka Sangraha. You do it to provide the example that becomes the establishment of the cosmic order of universal harmony. So don't run away from work, rather embrace it. Or whether his life and deeds are approved by his contemporaries, or he is condemned as a misleader of men and a fomenter of religious, moral, or social heresies. You'll remember that Krishna in the Mahabharata is not seen by most as an incarnate Godhead. They did not see him as an avatar. Only a few recognized in him that divinity. And many said, "You're trying to destroy Dharma. You are trying to destroy what holds together the world. If we follow you, perdition will follow us." So, even so, Krishna's work was promulgated as an aspect of the divine will, which played out all across India, but you could see it most visibly in the consciousness of Krishna if your eyes were opened. He played the role of a diplomat, of a counselor, so we go to the next paragraph then. But if his action is governed by no external rule, one rule it will observe that is not external. It will be dictated by no personal desire or aim, but will be a part of a conscious and eventually a well-ordered, because self-ordered, divine working in the world. The Gita declares that the action of the liberated man must be directed not by desire, but towards the keeping together of the world, its government, guidance, impulsion, maintenance in the path appointed to us. And this is Loka Sangraha, again, chapter 3, verse 20. This injunction has been interpreted in the sense that the world being an illusion in which most men must be kept since they are unfit for liberation, he must so act outwardly as to cherish in them an attachment to their customary works laid down for them by the social law, because they are so poor of intelligence and spirit that you have to consign to them this ordinary work, otherwise they'll run amok. No law will govern them, so they must take on the expedience of this social law. So Sri Aurobindo continues, if so, it would be a poor and petty rule, and every noble heart would reject it, to follow rather the divine vow of Amitabha Buddha, the sublime prayer of the Bhagavata, the passionate aspiration of Vivekananda, which we had read just last week. But if we accept rather the view that the world is a divinely guided movement of nature, emerging in man towards God, and that this is the work in which the Lord of the Gita declares that he is ever occupied, although he himself has nothing ungained that he has yet to win, then a deep and true sense will appear for this great injunction. to participate in that divine work, to live for God and the world, will be the rule of the Karma Yogin. To live for God and the world, and therefore so to act, that the divine may more and more manifest himself and the world go forward by whatever way of its obscure pilgrimage and move nearer to the divine ideal. So you can see in this passage, he is embracing the nature of the universality of the divine. This is the cosmic picture and how the liberated soul works for the divine in the cosmic situation. That verse that he was just alluding to is 3:22 in the Gita. I have no work that I need to do, kartavyam, in all the three worlds, nothing not gained, nothing yet to gain, and I abide in the paths of action. I continue to work. How he shall do this, in what particular way, can be decided by no general rule. It must develop or define itself from within. The decision lies between God and ourself, the supreme self and the individual self that is the instrument of the work. Even before liberation, it is from the inner self. As soon as we become conscious of it, that there rises the sanction, the spiritually determined choice. So we may not have fully realized what is our connection with the divine, what is the essence of our own being, but we do awake to it. And then begins a progressive movement towards the Godhead. So here, the Supreme Self, Paramatman, the Supreme Self, and the individual self, Jivatman. You'll remember that Sri Aurobindo has evoked before the scheme in the Bhagavad Gita, the metaphysical equation of the supreme person, Purushottama, with a supreme nature, Paraprakriti, which distributes into active manifestation itself, multiplied endlessly as the Jiva Bhuta. So all the jivas, in a sense, arise from the transcendence and move into the cosmic, representing aspects of this supreme soul, this supreme spirit, Paramatman, the supreme self, as he has it here. So this is what you secretly are, always. Could not possibly escape that because it is your real, your true nature. But it comes out in time. The evolution of consciousness in the cosmos reveals your nature, reveals your spirit, which allows you to make your spirit and your nature ultimately one. This is evolution's course upwards. So he continues. It is altogether from within that must come the knowledge of the work that has to be done. So it says you awaken to your soul, awaken to that connection with the transcendence, that will can shine in your consciousness and manifest it in your empowered action. There is no particular work, no law or form or outwardly fixed or invariable way of works, which can be said to be that of the liberated being. The phrase used in the Gita to express this work that has to be done has indeed been interpreted in the sense that we must do our duty without regard to the fruit. But this is a conception born of European culture, which is ethical rather than spiritual, and external rather than inwardly profound in its concepts. So this is we often refer to it as kartavyam karma, the work that must be done. But there is niyatam karma, which is rightly regulated action, then there is svabhava niyatam karma, which is action regulated by your true nature, which goes back to the nature of the jiva. And then there is muktasya karma, which is liberated work arising in regulation by the divine, because its will works within you and from above in you. So finally, you move from stage to stage until your action becomes muktasya, characterized by liberation. But this is something, of course, that with the externalities of ethics in the West, we have no idea about. This growth of interior recognition of what is the source of the motivation for work. We have no sense of that. Here is a charter. This is your duty. Read it, understand it, and do it. Well, the external shastra is something that has often bound souls everywhere. But in the West, we don't seem to have the inner doctrine that leads to liberation. So Sri Aurobindo returns to his argument now. So, let's get back to it. No such general thing as duty exists. We have only duties, often in conflict with each other. And these are determined by our environment, our social relations, our external status in life. Remember, Krishna has taken the shackles off Arjuna's vision at Kurukshetra when he comes into the collision of the dharmas, that one teaching fights another teaching. So which is right? And Krishna has to impose upon him a higher law, which demands from him an awakening to his inner spirit. There on the battlefield, that's an assignment. These duties are of great value in training the immature moral nature and setting up a standard which discourages the action of selfish nature. It has already been said that so long as the seeker has no inner light, he must govern himself by the best light he has, and duty, a principle, a cause, are among the standards he may temporarily erect and observe. But for all that, duties are external things, not stuff of the soul, and cannot be the ultimate standard of action in this path. It is the duty of the soldier to fight when called upon, even to fire upon his own kith and kin. But such a standard, or any akin to it, cannot be imposed on the liberated man. On the other hand, to love or have compassion, to obey the highest truth of our being, to follow the command of the divine, are not duties. These things are a law of the nature as it rises towards the divine, an outflowing of action from a soul state, a high reality of the spirit. The action of the liberated doer of works must be even such an outflowing from the soul. It must come to him or out of him as a natural result of his spiritual union with the divine, and not be formed by an edifying construction of the mental thought and will, the practical reason, or the social sense. In the ordinary life, a personal, social, or traditional constructed rule, standard, or ideal is the guide. Once the spiritual journey has begun, this must be replaced by an inner and outer rule or way of living necessary for our self-discipline, liberation, and perfection, a way of living proper to the path we follow, or enjoined by the spiritual guide and master, the guru, or else dictated by a guide within us. But in the last state of the soul's infinity and freedom, all outward standards are replaced or laid aside, and there is left only a spontaneous and integral obedience to the divine with whom we are in union, and an action spontaneously fulfilling the integral spiritual truth of our being and nature. So first, a note about spontaneous and spontaneously, from the Latin spontaneus, from sponte, of one's own accord. So, of one's own free will, acting from self-law, without premeditation, therefore, so if we go back to where we began, and Sri Aurobindo is describing that we're moving away from the binding forms of the finite into the free self-determination of the infinite, this is living in the spontaneous truth of your nature, arising from your own free will, from your authentic nature, from your swabhava, the manifestation of the truth of your jivahood. The idea of the spiritual guide and master, well, in the Upanishads, we don't see so much about the guru, we hear about the acharya, the one who sets the path, who gives you the instruction. Later in the tradition of the Tantra, of course, the guru occupies a central role in the whole process of the path of yoga. And guru, by the way, doesn't mean teacher. It means what is heavy, what has substance. So what has authority by dint of that substance. And so worthy of honor, worthy of listening to. Now, if we go back to the beginning of this section of Sri Aurobindo's synthesis of yoga, which he titled, upon revision, The Yoga of Divine Works, then we remember that he wrote about the four aids and the nature of the teacher was central to that. So let's look at a passage that touches upon that. In that chapter, the four aids, the surest way towards this integral fulfillment is to find the master of the secret who dwells within us. Open ourselves constantly to the divine power, which is also the divine wisdom and love, and trust to it to effect the conversion. But it is difficult for the egoistic consciousness to do this at all at the beginning. And if done at all, it is still difficult to do it perfectly and in every strand of our nature. Then he describes the nature of the teacher as it appears. The guru may sometimes be the incarnation or world teacher, but it is sufficient that he should represent to the disciple the divine wisdom, convey to him something of the divine ideal, or make him feel the realized relation of the human soul with the eternal. But he prefers that the seeker live in communion with the Jagadguru. The teacher of the integral yoga will follow as far as he may the method of the teacher within us. He will lead the disciple through the nature of the disciple. Teaching, example, influence, these are the three instruments of the guru. He is a man, helping his brothers, a child leading children, a light kindling other lights, an awakened soul, awakening souls, at highest, a power or presence of the divine, calling to him other powers of the divine. So I think that's a good place to break, and we'll finish the chapter next week, The Divine Work. But this high consummation that Sri Aurobindo has called us to brings us to a section in Savitri. In Book 11, the Book of Everlasting Day, the soul's choice and the supreme consummation. And this starts on 699. O Sunward, thou shalt raise the earth soul to light and bring down God into the lives of men. Earth shall be my work chamber and my house, my garden of life to plant a seed divine. When all thy work in human time is done, the mind of earth shall be a home of light, the life of earth a tree growing towards heaven, the body of earth a tabernacle of God. Awakened from the mortal's ignorance, men shall be lit with the eternal's ray, and the glory of my sun lift in their thoughts, and feel in their hearts the sweetness of my love, and in their acts my power's miraculous drive. My will shall be the meaning of their days. Living for me, by me, in me, they shall live. In the heart of my creation's mystery, I will enact the drama of thy soul, inscribe the long romance of thee and me. I will pursue thee across the centuries. Thou shalt be hunted through the world by love, naked of ignorance, protecting veil, and without covert from my radiant gods. No shape shall screen thee from my divine desire. Nowhere shalt thou escape my living eyes. In the nudity of thy discovered self, in a bare identity with all that is, disrobed of thy covering of humanity, divested of the dense veil of human thought, made one with every mind and body and heart, made one with all nature and with self and God, summing in thy single soul my mystic world, I will possess in thee my universe, the universe find all I am in thee. Thou shalt bear all things, that all things may change. Thou shalt fill all with my splendor and my bliss. Thou shalt meet all with thy transmuting soul. Assailed by my infinitudes above, and quivering in immensities below, pursued by me through my mind's wallless vast, oceanic with the surges of my life, a swimmer lost between two leaping seas, by my outer pains and inner sweetnesses, finding my joy in my opposite mysteries, thou shalt respond to me from every nerve. A vision shall compel thy coursing breath. Thy heart shall drive thee on the wheel of thoughts. My mind shall urge thee through the flames of thought, to meet me in the abyss and on the heights, to feel me in the tempest and the calm, and love me in the noble and the vile, in beautiful things and terrible desire. The pains of hell shall be to thee my kiss, the flowers of heaven persuade thee with my touch. My fiercest masks shall my attractions bring. Music shall find thee in the voice of swords. Beauty pursue thee through the core of flame. Thou shalt know me in the rolling of the spheres, and cross me in the atoms of the whirl. The wheeling forces of my universe shall cry to thee the summons of my name. Delight shall drop down from my nectarous moon. My fragrance seize thee in the jasmine's snare. My eye shall look upon thee from the sun. Mirror of nature's secret spirit made, thou shalt reflect my hidden heart of joy. Thou shalt drink down my sweetness unalloyed in my pure lotus cup of starry brim. My dreadful hands laid on thy bosom shall force thy being bathed in fiercest longing's streams. Thou shalt discover the one and quivering note, and cry the harp of all my melodies, and roll my foaming wave in seas of love. The passage continues, and I invite you to read it all. Namaste, Jai Ma.